art, while trading was more like a sport, something that required skill, but not necessarily brains or creativity, or so the thinking went. Traders had always been a notch lower in the pecking order, even when they started to drive revenue growth. The combative Glucksman encouraged this us-against-them mentality among his trading staff. "Fucking bankers!" was a constant refrain. Once, Glucksman heard that Peter Lusk, a successful banker in Lehman's Los Angeles office in the 1970s, had spent $368,000 to decorate his office with crystal chandeliers, wood-paneled walls, and a wet bar. Glucksman immediately got on a plane to the West Coast and went straight to Lusk's office, which was unoccupied when he showed up. Horrified by the decor, he rummaged around a secretary's desk, found a piece of paper, scribbled a message in block letters, and taped it on the door. "You're fired." He didn't leave it at that. Glucksman returned to the secretary's desk, grabbed another piece of paper, and wrote an addendum to his previous message, taping it right below. "And you will pay Lehman Brothers back every cent you spent on this office." In 1983, Glucksman led one of Wall Street's most memorable coups, which ended with an immigrant. Glucksman was a second-generation Hungarian Jew, deposing one of the most connected leaders in the industry, Peter G. Peterson, a former Commerce Secretary in the Nixon administration. During their final confrontation, Glucksman looked Peterson in the eye and told him he could go easy or he could go hard, and Peterson, who went on to co-found the powerful Blackstone Group, went easy. Glucksman, who became more diplomatic with age, never liked talking about the clash. "That's kind of like talking about my first wife," he remarked years later. Glucksman's tenure as the head of Lehman was short-lived. 8 months later, on April 10, 1984, a day Fuld called the darkest of his life, the company's 17-member corporate board voted to sell out to American Express for $360 million. It had been Peterson's loyalists who had initiated contact with American Express, making the deal, in effect, a counter-coup. And it prevailed for more than a decade, until the original insurgents fought back and won. Shearson Lehman, as the newly combined investment arm was known, involved merging Lehman with Amex's retail brokerage operations, Shearson. The idea was to combine brains and brawn, but the relationship was troubled from the start. Perhaps the biggest mistake the corporate parent made was not immediately firing the Lehman managers, who had made it clear that they thought the whole deal had been a big mistake. At the time of the merger, Fuld, who was already a member of Lehman's board, had been one of just three directors to oppose the sale. "I loved this place," he said in casting his dissenting vote. Glucksman, Fuld, Gregory, and the rest of Glucksman's inner circle would spend the next decade fighting to preserve Lehman's autonomy and identity. "It was like a 10-year prison sentence," recalled Gregory. To encourage their solidarity, Glucksman summoned Fuld and his other top traders to a meeting in the firm's conference room. For reasons no one quite understood, Glucksman was holding a few dozen number two pencils in his hand. He handed each trader one and asked him to snap it in half, which everyone did, easily and without laughing or even smirking. He then handed a bunch of them to Fuld and asked him to try to break them all in half. Fuld, the gorilla, could not do it. "Stay together, and you will continue to do great things," Glucksman told the group after this zen-like demonstration. Lehman's traders and executives chafed at being part of a financial supermarket. The very name suggested something common. To make things worse, the new management structure bordered on Byzantine. Fuld was named co-president and co-chief operating officer of Shearson Lehman Brothers Holdings in 1993, along with J. Tomlinson Hill. They reported to a Shearson chief executive, who reported to American Express's chief, Harvey Golub. A Fuld protege, T. Christopher Pettit, ran the investment banking and trading division. No one really knew who was in charge, or, for that matter, if anyone was in charge at all. When a red-faced Amex finally spun off Lehman in 1994, the firm was undercapitalized and focused almost entirely on trading bonds. Stars like Stephen A. Schwarzman, the future CEO of Blackstone, had left the company. No one expected it to survive for long as an independent firm. It was just takeover bait for a much larger bank. American Express CEO Harvey Gulab anointed Fuld, who was Shearson Lehman's top trader and had risen to be co-president and chief executive of the newly independent entity. Fuld had his work cut out for him. Lehman was reeling, with net revenue plunging by a third when the Shearson units were sold. Investment banking was down by nearly the same amount. They were bailing water. And the infighting continued. By 1996, Fuld pushed out Pettit when he made noises about increasing his status. Pettit died 3 months later in a snowmobile accident. For years, Fuld operated the firm alone, until he appointed Gregory and another colleague, Bradley Jack, to the role of co-COO in 2002. But Jack was quickly pushed out by Gregory, who had the confidence of Fuld in part because of his talent and, perhaps more important, because he appeared non-threatening. "You're the best business fixer I have," Fuld told him, vowing that with Gregory's help, he would do away with the backbiting that had nearly torn the firm apart in the 1980s. Fuld began by slashing payroll. By the end of 1996, the staff had shrunk by 20% to around 7,500 employees. At the same time that he was downsizing, he was adopting a smoother management style. To his own surprise, Fuld proved to be good at massaging egos, wooing new talent, and, perhaps most shocking for a trader, schmoozing clients. As Fuld recast himself as the public face of the firm, Gregory became the chief operating officer. Inside to Fuld's Mr. Outside. Yes, Fuld had become one of the fucking bankers, intently focused on one goal, boosting the newly public company's stock price. Lehman shares were increasingly doled out to employees. Eventually, the workforce owned a third of the firm. "I want my employees to act like owners," Fuld told his managers. To encourage teamwork, he adopted a point system similar to the one he had used to reward his son, Richie, when he played hockey. Fuld taped his son's games and would inform him, "You get 1 point for a goal, but 2 points for an assist." He had some other choice paternal advice for his son that he also applied at Lehman. "If one of your teammates gets attacked, fight back like hell." At Lehman, senior executives were compensated based on the performances of their team. If you were loyal to Fuld, he was loyal to you. Almost everyone at Lehman had heard the story about his vacation with James Tisch, the chief executive of Lowe's, and his family. The group went hiking together in Bryce Canyon National Park in Utah. Nearly a mile down from the rim of the canyon, Tisch's 10-year-old son Ben had an asthma attack and began panicking when he realized he had left his inhaler back on top of the canyon. Fuld and Tisch took charge, helping the boy to make the hike back. "Ben, lead the way," Fuld instructed, trying to build up the boy's confidence. Halfway up, they encountered another hiker who looked at Ben and said, "My, aren't we wheezy today?" Fuld, without slowing, turned on him and shouted with a memorable ferocity, "Eat shit and die! Eat shit and die!" Exhilarated by Fold's defense of him, Ben nearly ran up the rest of the way. Perhaps Fold's greatest moment as a leader came after the 9/11 attacks. As the world was literally crumbling around him, he instilled a spirit of camaraderie that helped keep the firm together. The day after the towers were hit, Fuld attended a meeting at the New York Stock Exchange to discuss when it should reopen. Asked if Lehman would be able to trade, he told the room, almost on the verge of tears, "We don't even know who's alive." In the final reckoning, Lehman lost only one employee. But the firm's global headquarters at 3 World Financial Center was so severely damaged, it was unusable. Fuld set up makeshift offices for his 6,500 employees at a Sheraton hotel on 7th Avenue in Midtown. A few weeks later, he personally negotiated a deal to buy a building from one of his arch-rivals, Morgan Stanley, which had never moved into its new headquarters. Within a month, Lehman Brothers was up and running in a new location as if nothing at all had happened. But there was one casualty of the move. Fuld's stuffed gorilla was lost in the shuffle and never replaced. Gregory later pointed out that both Fuld and the firm had outgrown it. For all his talk about change, however, Fuld did not so much overhaul Lehman's corporate culture as tweak it. He instituted a subtler version of the paranoid, combative worldview propagated by Glucksman. The martial metaphors remained. Every day is a battle, Fuld barked at his executives. You have to kill the enemy. But traders and bankers were no longer at each other's throats, and for a while, at least, Lehman was less riven by internal strife. I tried to train investment bankers to understand the products they were selling, Glucksman said long after Fuld had gone on to be CEO. We were one of the first firms to put investment bankers on the trading floor, and Dick has gone far beyond where I was when I left the firm. Fuld eventually decided that Lehman was too conservative, too dependent on trading bonds and other debts. Seeing the enormous profits that Goldman Sachs made by investing its own money, he wanted the firm to branch out. It fell on Gregory to execute the boss's vision. Though he was not by nature a details guy or a risk manager, Gregory played a pivotal role in the firm's increasingly aggressive bets, pushing Lehman into commercial real estate, mortgages, and leveraged lending. And in a galloping bull market, its profits and share price soared to unprecedented heights. Gregory was rewarded with $5 million in cash and $29 million in stock in 2007. Fuld made a package worth $40 million that year. Gregory also handled Fuld's less desirable conversations. Whenever a personnel matter called for discipline, the rebuke usually came from Gregory. The person on the receiving end invariably referred to the new asshole he had just been provided. Around the office, Gregory was known as Darth Vader. Though Fuld was unaware of it, Gregory's heavy-handed tactics were regular fodder at the water cooler. In 2005, Gregory made one of his harshest personnel decisions, one that would become legend within the firm. He inexplicably sidelined his protege and longtime favorite, Robert Shafir, Lehman's global head of equities, who had helped him build that business, for what seemed like no reason. Gregory, who said he'd find him another role at the firm, then kicked him off the firm's executive committee. In case Shafir hadn't gotten the message, Gregory then gave him an office right across from the conference room where the executive committee met, a cruel reminder of his diminished status. In the middle of all this, Shafir's daughter was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis, and he took some time off, hoping that when he returned to the firm, Gregory might have a job for him. But when Shafir failed to resign after a few months, Gregory called him into his office. "What do you think about moving to Asia?" he asked him after an awkward silence. Shafir was dumbstruck. "Asia? You have to be kidding, Joe. You know about my kid. You know I can't go to Asia." Shafir left the firm for Credit Suisse, perhaps the most notorious victim of what people inside Lehman referred to as a Joeicide. Some of Gregory's hiring decisions, meanwhile, struck people as highly unorthodox. In 2005, he took the firm's head of fixed income, Bart McDade, who was an expert in the world of debt, and made him the head of equities, a business he knew very little about. In 2007, as the property bubble neared the breaking point, Gregory was asked repeatedly why so many of the executives he placed in the commercial real estate business had no background in that area. "People need broad experience," Gregory explained. "It's the power of the machine. It's not the individual." Of all the individuals whom Gregory anointed, none was more controversial than Aaron Callan, a striking blonde who favored Sex and the City-style stilettos. When he chose the 41-year-old Callan as the firm's new chief financial officer in September 2007, Lehman insiders were stunned Callan was obviously bright, but she knew precious little about the firm's treasury operations and had no background in accounting whatsoever. Another woman at the firm, Roz Stevenson, perhaps the only Lehman banker besides Fould, who could get Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts, Kingpin, Henry Kravis on the phone, was furious about the appointment and took her complaint directly to Dick Fould, who, as always, backed Gregory. Callan yearned to prove to her colleagues that she was a seasoned street fighter, just like Fould. If anything, her path to the very top of the financial industry had been even more improbable than his. One of three daughters of a New York City police officer, she graduated from NYU Law School in 1990 and took a job working for the big Wall Street firm Simpson, Thacker, and Bartlett as an associate in its tax department. Lehman Brothers was a major client. After 5 years at Simpson, she took a chance one day and phoned her contact at Lehman. "Would it be weird for someone like me to work on Wall Street?" she asked. No, it would not. Hired by Lehman, she caught a break early on when a change in the tax law sparked a boom in securities that were taxed as if they were debt. Callan, with her tax law expertise, became adept at structuring these complex investments for clients like General Mills. Savvy, confident, and a skillful pitchwoman, she quickly catapulted up the ranks, overseeing the firm's Global Finance Solutions and Global Finance Analytic groups within a few years. Hedge funds were becoming top Wall Street clients, and in 2006, Callan was entrusted with the critical job of overseeing the firm's investment banking relationships with them. In this role, she solidified her reputation as a player by helping Fortress Investment Group become the first American manager of hedge funds and private equity funds to go public. She later oversaw the initial public offering of another fund, the Auk Ziff Capital Management Group. For Lehman's most important hedge fund client, Ken Griffin's Citadel Investment Group, she orchestrated the sale of $500 million worth of 5-year bonds, a groundbreaking offering by a hedge fund. She soon caught the eye of Joe Gregory, an executive who believed strongly in the value of diversity. He recognized that the world was changing, and that Lehman, as well as the rest of the financial community, could no longer be a sanctuary for white men only. Promoting someone who was young and smart and a woman would be good for Lehman and would reflect well on him. It didn't hurt that Callan looked great on television. On the night of March 17th, in her apartment at the Time Warner Center, Erin Callan endlessly tossed and turned. The next day was going to be the biggest of her career, a chance to single-handedly extinguish the flames threatening to engulf Lehman, and to prove her critics inside the firm wrong. In just a few hours, Callan would represent Lehman Brothers, to the market, to the world. She would run the crucial conference call detailing the firm's quarterly results. Scores of financial analysts from around the nation would be listening in. Many of them would be ready to shred Lehman at the slightest sign of weakness. After presenting Lehman's numbers, there'd be questions. And given all that was going on, there'd probably be a few very tough ones that would force Callan to think on her feet. Her answers might literally make or break the firm. Finally, giving up on getting any sleep, she rolled out of bed and grabbed the Wall Street Journal outside her apartment door. The page one story did nothing to alleviate her nerves. Its headline read, "Lehman finds itself in center of a storm," and it featured her as one of the main Lehman executives fighting back rumors about the firm's failing health. But she liked the press. Despite her fatigue, Callan was fired up, adrenaline coursing through her slender body. She dashed downstairs, coffee in hand, dressed in an elegant black suit picked out by her personal shopper at Bergdorf Goodman. She had blown her hair out for an appearance later that day on Closing Bell with Maria Bartiromo on CNBC. She waited for her driver under the awning of the Time Warner Center. She was hoping her place there would be only temporary. With her new job title and expected income, she had been looking to upgrade and was in negotiations to buy her dream home, a 2,400-square-foot apartment on the 31st floor of 15 Central Park West, one of the most coveted addresses in New York City. The limestone building, designed by Robert A.M. Stern, was the new home to such storied financiers as Goldman Sachs's Lloyd Blankfein, Citigroup's legendary Sanford Weill, hedge fund maestro Daniel Loeb, and the rock star Sting. She was planning to borrow $5 million to pay for the $6.48 million space. As she entered the back seat of the company car, she reflected on how much was at stake this morning, including the new apartment she wanted. In his office at Lehman, Dick Fuld steadied his nerves and got ready to watch Treasury Secretary Paulson live on CNBC. He reached for the remote and turned up the volume. Matt Lauer of the Today Show was conducting the interview, simulcast on both NBC and CNBC. "I don't want to make too much of words," Lauer began, "but I would like to talk to you about the president's words that he used on Monday after meeting with you. He said, 'Secretary Paulson gave me an update, and it's clear that we're in challenging times.'" Paulson, looking sleep-deprived, was standing in the White House press room, straining to listen to the question coming through in his right ear. Lauer continued, "I want to contrast that to what Alan Greenspan wrote in an article recently," he said. A photo of Greenspan flashed on the screen accompanying his quote. "The current financial crisis in the U.S. is likely to be judged in retrospect as the most wrenching since the end of the Second World War." "Doesn't 'we're in challenging times' seem like the understatement of the year?" Lauer asked in his polite but persistent style. Paulson stammered for a moment, then recovered and continued with what he clearly hoped was a soothing message. "Matt, there's turbulence in our capital markets, and it's been going on since August. We're all over it. We are looking for ways to work our way through it. I've got great confidence in our markets. They're resilient, they're flexible. But this has taken some time, and we're focused on it." Fuld waited with growing impatience for Lauer to ask about the implications of the Bear Stearns bailout. "The Fed took some extraordinary steps over the weekend to deal with the Bear Stearns situation," Lauer finally said. "It has some people asking, does the Fed react more strongly to what's happening on Wall Street than they do to what's happening to people in pain across the country, the so-called people who live on Main Street?" An exasperated Fuld thought Lauer's question was just another example of the popular media's tendency to frame complex financial issues in terms of class warfare, pitting Wall Street and Paulson, Goldman's former CEO, against the nation's soccer moms, the Today Show's audience. Paulson paused as he searched for his words. "Let me say that the Bear Stearns situation has been very painful for the Bear Stearns shareholders, so I don't think that they think that they've been bailed out here." He was obviously trying to send a message. The Bush administration isn't in the business of bailouts, period. Then, Lauer, quoting from the front page of the Wall Street Journal, asked, "Has the government set a precedent for propping up failing financial institutions at a time when its more traditional tools don't appear to be working?" In other words, they're saying, is this now the wave of the future, Mr. Secretary? That financial institutions that get in trouble in the future turn to the government to get bailed out? It was a particularly poignant question. Only nights before, Paulson had railed on a conference call with all the Wall Street CEOs about moral hazard, that woolly economic term that describes what happens when risk-takers are shielded from the consequences of failure. They might take ever greater risks. "Well, again, as I said, I don't believe the Bear Stearns shareholders feel they've been bailed out right now," Paulson repeated. "The focus is clearly, all of our focus, is on what's best for the American people and how to minimize the impact of the disruption in the capital markets." When she sat down at her desk, Callan turned on her Bloomberg terminal and waited for Goldman Sachs to announce its results for the quarter, which the market would take as a rough barometer of the shape of things to come. If Goldman did well, it could give Lehman an added boost. When Goldman's numbers popped up on her screen, she was delighted. They were solid. $1.5 billion in profits. down from $3.2 billion. But who wasn't down from a year ago? Goldman handily beat expectations. So far, so good. That morning, Lehman Brothers had already sent out a press release summarizing its first quarter results. As Callan knew, of course, the numbers were confidence-inspiring. The firm was reporting earnings of $489 million, or 81 cents per share, off 57% from the previous quarter, but higher than analysts' forecasts. The first news service dispatches on the earnings release were positive. Lehman kind of confounded the doomsayers with these numbers, Michael Holland of Holland & Company, the private investment firm, told Reuters. Michael Hecht, an analyst with Bank of America Securities, called the quarterly results, all in all, solid. At 10 o'clock a.m., a half hour after the market opened, Callan entered the boardroom on the 31st floor. Though Lehman's results were already calming market fears, a great deal was still riding on her performance. Surely everyone listening in would ask the same questions. How was Lehman different from Bear Stearns? How strong was its liquidity position? How was it valuing its real estate portfolio? Could investors really believe Lehman's marks, the way the firm valued its assets? Or was Lehman playing mark to make believe? Callan had answers to all of them. She had prepped and studied and gone through dry runs. She had even rehearsed the numbers for a roomful of Securities and Exchange officials, hardly the easiest crowd, over the weekend, and they left satisfied. She knew the numbers cold. She knew by heart the story that needed to be told, and she knew how to tell it. The markets roared their approval of the earnings report. Shares of Lehman surged while the credit spreads tightened. Investors now perceived the risk that the firm would fail had diminished. All that had to happen now was for Callan to supply the punctuation. She took a sip of water. Her voice was raspy after talking non-stop for 4 straight days. "All set?" asked Ed Grieb, Lehman's director of investor relations. Callan nodded and began. "There's no question the last few days have seen unprecedented volatility, not only in our sector, but also across the whole marketplace," she said into the speakerphone, as dozens of financial analysts listened. Her voice was calm and steady. For the next 30 minutes, she ran through the numbers for Lehman's business units, carefully elucidating the specifics or, in the jargon of Wall Street, providing the color. She put particular emphasis on the firm's efforts to reduce leverage and increase liquidity. She spelled it all out in painstaking, mind-numbing detail. It was a stellar presentation. The analysts on the call seemed impressed by Callan's candor, her command of the facts, her assuredness, and her willingness to acknowledge the outstanding problems. But she wasn't finished yet. Next came the questions. First up was Meredith Whitney, an analyst with Oppenheimer, who had made her name as an unsparing banking critic the previous fall, with the accurate prediction that Citigroup would be forced to cut its dividend. Callan, as well as every other Lehman executive in the room, held their breaths as they waited for Whitney to start probing. "You did a great job, Aaron," Whitney said to everyone's amazement. "I really appreciate the disclosure. I'm sure everyone does." Callan, trying hard not to show her relief, knew then that she had pulled it off. If Whitney was buying it, all was well. As they spoke, shares of Lehman continued spiking. The markets were buying it, too. The stock would end the day up $14.74, or 46.4%, to $46.49, for the biggest one-day gain in the stock since it went public in 1994. William Tanana, an analyst with Goldman Sachs, raised his rating on Lehman to buy from neutral. When the session ended, the excitement at Lehman was palpable. Gregory rushed over to give Callan a big hug. Later, as she went down to the bond trading floor, she passed by the desk of Peter Hornick, the firm's head of collateralized debt obligation sales and trading. He held out his palm, and she slapped him a high five. For a brief, shining moment, all seemed well at Lehman Brothers. Outside Lehman, however, skeptics were already voicing their concerns. I still don't believe any of these numbers because I still don't think there is proper accounting for the liabilities they have on their books. Peter Schiff, president and chief global strategist of Euro-Pacific Capital, told the Washington Post. People are going to find out that all these profits they made were phony. Across town, a prescient young hedge fund manager named David Einhorn, who had just gotten off a red-eye flight from Los Angeles and had raced to his office to listen to the call that morning, was coming to the same conclusion. Lehman was a house of cards. He was one of those hedgies investors Fold had railed about. And he was so influential, he could move markets just by uttering a sentence. He had already bet big money that the firm was more vulnerable than Callan was letting on, and he was getting ready to share his opinion with the world. Chapter 2. In a leafy enclave of northwest Washington, D.C., Hank Paulson was pacing back and forth in his living room, his cell phone sitting in its usual place. It was Easter Sunday, exactly 1 week after the takeover of Bear Stearns, and Paulson had promised his wife, Wendy, that they'd take a bicycle ride in Rock Creek Park, the large public space that bisects the Capitol, just down the road from their home. She had been annoyed with him all weekend for spending so much time on the phone. "Come on, just for an hour," she said, trying to coax him out of the house. He finally relented. It was the first time in more than a week that he would try to take his mind off work, until his phone rang again. Seconds later, after hearing what the caller had to say, the Treasury Secretary exclaimed, "That makes me want to vomit." It was Jamie Dimon on his speakerphone from his wood-paneled office on the 8th floor of J.P. Morgan's headquarters in Midtown Manhattan, overlooking a barren Park Avenue. He had just told Paulson something the Treasury Secretary didn't want to hear. Dimon had decided to recut his $2 a share deal for Bear Stearns and raise the price to $10. The news wasn't completely unexpected. Paulson, who could be relentless, had phoned Dimon virtually every day that week, interrupting his early morning treadmill jog at least once. And based on those conversations, he knew a higher price for Bear was a possibility. In the days since announcing the deal, both men had become justifiably worried that disgruntled Bear shareholders would vote down the deal in protest of the low price, creating another run on the firm. But Dimon's decision still roiled Paulson. He had expected that if Dimon did raise the price, he'd hike it by no more than a few dollars, up to $8 a share, say, but not into double digits. "That's more than we talked about," replied Paulson, who was now whispering into the phone in his unmistakable raspy voice, hardly able to believe what he was hearing. Just a week earlier, when Dimon had indicated that he was prepared to pay $4 a share, Paulson had privately instructed him to lower the price. "I could see something nominal, like $1 or $2 per share," he had said. The fact was, Bear was insolvent without the government's offer to backstop $29 billion of its debt, and Paulson did not want to be seen as a patsy, bailing out his friends on Wall Street. "I can't see why they're getting anything," he told Dimon. So far, nobody other than Dimon knew that the Treasury Secretary of the United States of America was behind the original paltry sale price, and Paulson wanted to keep it that way. Like most conservatives, he still honored the principle of the invisible hand, that widely held neoclassical economic notion that official intervention was at best a last resort. As a former CEO himself, Paulson understood Dimon's position perfectly well. He, too, wanted to restore calm to the markets, for it had been a nail-biter of a week. After the $2 a share purchase price had been announced, Bear's shareholders and employees had practically revolted, threatening to upend not just the deal, but also the entire market. And in the hastily arranged merger agreement, Dimon had found a glaring error, which he blamed on his lawyers, Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. Bear's shareholders could vote against the deal, and J.P. Morgan would still be on the hook to guarantee its trades for an entire year. Dimon recounted to Paulson how Ed Moldaver, a longtime broker at Bear, an asshole in Dimon's estimation, had publicly mocked him during a meeting Diamond had called to explain the transaction to Bear employees. "This isn't a shotgun marriage," Maldaver scowled in front of hundreds of Bear staffers. "This is more like a rape." In Washington, Paulson now revealed to Diamond that he was facing a similar revolt. For most people in government thought everyone on Wall Street was greedy and overpaid, and bailing them out was about as popular a notion as raising taxes. "I'm getting it from all sides," he confided. To make matters worse, it was a presidential election year. On Monday, a day after the Bear Stearns deal was announced, Democratic candidate Senator Hillary Clinton, who at the time had a slight lead in national polls, criticized the bailout, going so far as to link the Bush administration's rescue of Bear Stearns to the problems in Iraq. Barney Frank, the Democratic chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, was every bit as harsh. He, too, turned the deal into an indictment of Paulson's boss, President Bush. "All these years of deregulation by the Republicans and the absence of regulation as these new financial instruments have grown have allowed them to take a large chunk of the economy hostage," Frank complained. "And we have to pay ransom, like it or not." While attacking the rescue plan was one of the few completely bipartisan affairs in town, the Republicans hated it for different reasons. The conservatives believed that the marketplace would take care of everything, and that any government intervention was bound to make things worse. "First, do no harm," they'd say, quoting Hippocrates' Epidemics. A little blood might be spilled, but creative destruction was one of the costs of capitalism. Moderate Republicans, meanwhile, were inundated with complaints from their constituents, who wondered why the parties responsible for decimating their 401ks deserved any taxpayer money at all. Everyone was calling it a bailout, a word Paulson hated. As far as he was concerned, he had just helped save the American economy. It was a bailout in the literal sense of bailing water out of a sinking boat, not a handout. He didn't understand why no one in Washington could see that distinction. At some level, though, he knew there would be hell to pay, no matter how correct his prognosis proved to be. While the president publicly praised him and the deal, Bush privately was livid. The president understood the necessity of the bailout, but he also appreciated how it would be politicized. "We're going to get killed on this, aren't we?" he had asked Paulson, knowing full well that the answer was yes. Paulson didn't need to be reminded where the president stood on the issue. The Wednesday before the Bear deal, Paulson had spent the afternoon in the Oval Office advising Bush on the speech he would give that coming Friday to the Economic Club of New York at the Hilton Hotel. Bush had included a line in his remarks asserting that there would be no bailouts. "Don't say that," Paulson insisted, looking over the draft. "Why?" Bush asked. "We're not going to have a bailout." Paulson broke the bad news to him. "You may need a bailout, as bad as that sounds." All in all, the situation had become Paulson's worst nightmare. The economy had turned into a political football, his reputation was on the line, and he was stuck playing by Washington rules. Henry Paulson's understanding of how things worked in the nation's capital was part of the reason he had turned down the job of Treasury Secretary not once, but twice in the spring of 2006. He knew Washington. His first job after college had been at the Defense Department, and he had worked in the Nixon White House for a number of years after that. So he appreciated the risks that the job presented. "I will get down here and I won't be able to work with these people, and I'll leave with a bad reputation. Look at what people said about Snow and O'Neill," he said. His predecessors, John Snow and Paul O'Neill, had both come to Washington as wizards of their respective industries, but had departed with their legacies tarnished. He agonized for months before making his decision. As far as he was concerned, he already had the best job in the world, CEO of Goldman Sachs, the most revered institution on Wall Street. As its chief executive, Paulson traveled around the world, focusing much of his attention on China, where he had become something of an unofficial U.S. ambassador of capitalism, arguably forging deeper relationships with Chinese leaders than had anyone in Washington, including the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. Joshua Bolten, President Bush's new chief of staff, was pushing especially hard for Paulson to come on board. He had convinced the president that Paulson's close ties in China could be a huge plus, given the rapid and geopolitically significant rise of the Chinese economy. Professionally, Bolten knew Paulson well. A former Goldman Sachs insider himself, he had worked for the firm as a lobbyist in London in the 1990s and served briefly as the chief of staff to John Corzine when he headed the firm. But Bolten wasn't making any headway with Paulson, or the Paulson family, for that matter. It didn't help that Paulson's wife, Wendy, could not stand the president, even though her husband had been a pioneer for Bush in 2004, a designation given to those who raised more than $100,000 for the president's re-election campaign. His mother, Mariana, was so aghast at the idea that she cried. Paulson's son, a National Basketball Association executive, and daughter, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, were also initially against his making the move. Another key doubter was Paulson's mentor, John Whitehead, a former Goldman chairman and a father figure to many at the bank who had served in the State Department under Reagan. Whitehead thought it would be a big mistake. "This is a failed administration," he insisted. "You'll have a hard time getting anything accomplished." In an interview in April, Paulson was still dismissing talk that he was a candidate for Treasury Secretary, telling the Wall Street Journal, "I love my job. I actually think I've got the best job in the business world. I plan to be here for a good while." Meanwhile, Bolten kept pushing. Toward the end of April, Paulson accepted an invitation to meet with the president. But Goldman's chief of staff, John F.W. Rogers, who had served under James Baker in both the Reagan and the G.H.W. Bush administrations, urged him not to attend the meeting unless he was going to accept the position. "You do not go to explore jobs with the president," he told Paulson. Rogers' point was impossible to dispute, so Paulson awkwardly called to send his regrets. Paulson and his wife, however, did attend a luncheon at the White House that month for President Hu Jintao of China. After the meal, they took a stroll in the Capitol, and as they walked past the Treasury building, Wendy turned to him. "I hope you didn't turn it down because of me," she said, "because if you really wanted to do it, it's okay with me." "No, that's not why I turned it down." Despite his reluctance, others believed Paulson's decision was not quite final, and Rogers, for one, thought his boss secretly did want the job. On the first Sunday afternoon of May, he found himself fretting in his home in Georgetown, wondering whether he had given Paulson bad advice. He finally picked up the phone and called Bolten. "I know Hank told you no," he told him, "but if the president really wants him, you should ask him again." When Bolten called and repeated his pitch, Paulson wondered whether his resistance to the overtures was really a matter of a fear of failure. At Goldman, he was known as someone who runs to problems. Was he now running away from them? Paulson is a devout Christian Scientist, and, like most members of the faith, he deeply admires the writings of Mary Baker Eddy, who, seeking to reclaim early Christianity's focus on healing, founded the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston in 1879. "Fear is the fountain of sickness," she wrote. "Fear must be cast out to readjust the balance for God." Paulson was already having second thoughts about turning down the Treasury job when James Baker followed up on Bolton's call. Baker, the GOP's eminent Greece, confided to him that he had told the president that Paulson was by far the best candidate for the position. Deeply flattered, Paulson assured him that he was giving the idea serious consideration. That same week, John Bryan, the chief executive of Sara Lee and a longtime friend, Goldman director and client of Paulson's from when he was an investment banker in Chicago, offered him this advice. "Hank, life is not a dress rehearsal," he said. "You don't want to be sitting around at 80 years old telling your grandchildren you were once asked to be Secretary of the Treasury. You should tell them you did it." Paulson finally accepted the position on May 21st, but because the White House did not plan to announce the appointment until the following week after running a background check, He was left in the awkward predicament of attending the annual meeting of Goldman Partners that weekend in Chicago without being able to tell anyone that he was resigning. Ironically enough, the guest speaker that day was the junior senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. But with the newspapers, not to mention his colleagues, still speculating about whether he would join the administration, Paulson hid upstairs in his hotel room throughout the event. On Wall Street, there are two kinds of bankers: the silky, smooth salesmen, who succeed based on wits and charm, and those who persist with bulldog tenacity. Paulson was of the latter type, as the White House soon discovered. Before he officially accepted the job, Paulson made certain to see to a few key details. If 32 years at Goldman Sachs had taught him anything, it was how to cut the best deal possible. He demanded assurances, in writing, that Treasury would have the same status in the cabinet as defense and state. In Washington, he knew, proximity to the president mattered, and he had no intention of being a marginalized functionary who could be summoned at Bush's whim, but couldn't get the chief executive to return his calls. Somehow, he even got the White House to agree that its National Economic Council, headed by Alan Hubbard, a Harvard Business School classmate of Paulson's, would hold some of its meetings at the Treasury Building, and that the vice president, Dick Cheney, would attend them in person. Hoping to silence any suggestion that he would favor his former employer, he voluntarily signed an extensive 6-page ethics agreement that barred him from involving himself with Goldman Sachs for his entire tenure. His declaration went far beyond the regular 1-year time period required for government employees. As a prudential matter, I will not participate in any particular matter involving specific parties in which the Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated is or represents a party for the duration of my tenure as Secretary of the Treasury, he wrote in a letter that served as the agreement. I believe that these steps will ensure that I avoid even the appearance of a conflict of interest in the performance of my duties as Secretary of the Treasury. It was an avowal that would certainly hinder his power, given Goldman's role in virtually every aspect of Wall Street, and one that he would later desperately try to find ways around. One additional condition came with the appointment. Paulson would have to divest his huge holding of Goldman Sachs stock, some 3.23 million shares, worth about $485 million, as well as a lucrative investment in a Goldman fund that held a stake in the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. Because new Internal Revenue Service rules allowed executives who entered into government service to sell their interests without a penalty, Paulson saved more than $100 million in taxes. It was, perhaps, one of the most lucrative deals he ever struck. But for many months prior to the crisis, he watched chagrined as Goldman's shares rose from about $142 when he sold them to their high of $235.92 in October 2007. Henry Merritt Paulson, Jr. was officially nominated for Treasury Secretary on May 30, 2006. Just 7 days later, the Washington Post featured a profile of him that opened, "In an administration with just 2.5 years to go, Henry M. Paulson, Jr., President Bush's nominee for Treasury Secretary, may have little chance to make a mark on many economic issues." Nothing could have played more effectively to his immediate sense of buyer's remorse, and motivate him to overcome the challenge. By Wall Street standards, Paulson was something of a baffling outlier, a titan who had little interest in living a Carnegie Hill multimillionaire's life. A straight-shooting Midwesterner, he had grown up on a farm outside Chicago and had been an Eagle Scout. He and Wendy assiduously avoided the Manhattan society scene, trying to get to bed before 9 o'clock p.m. as often as they could, and preferred bird-watching in Central Park. Wendy led tours in the mornings for the Nature Conservancy, near their 2-bedroom, 1,200-square-foot apartment, a modest residence for one of the highest-paid executives on Wall Street. Paulson wore a plastic running watch, and any inclination he might have had to spend money was discouraged by Wendy, the daughter of a Marine officer whose frugality had kept him firmly grounded. One day, Paulson came home with a new cashmere coat from Bergdorf Goodman to replace one that he had had for 10 years. "Why did you buy a new coat?" Wendy asked. The next day, Paulson returned it. And despite his prodigious fundraising for President Bush, he hardly fit the image of a Republican hardliner. A hardcore environmentalist, whose only car was a Toyota Prius, he was the subject of a good deal of negative publicity, and the scourge of some annoyed Goldman Sachs shareholders when in 2006 he donated 680,000 acres of land Goldman owned in the South American archipelago of Tierra del Fuego to the Wildlife Conservation Society. He was WCS chairman, as it happened, and his son was one of its advisors. Although the irony could not be appreciated by anyone at the time, the firm had acquired the ecologically sensitive South American land as part of a portfolio of mortgage defaults. Paulson had a long history of exceeding others' expectations. Despite his relatively modest frame, 6 feet 1, 195 pounds, he had been an all-Ivy League tackle for Dartmouth, where his ferociousness in playing earned him the nicknames The Hammer and Hammering Hank. But unlike his hard-partying teammates, he kept orange juice and ginger ale in a refrigerator at his fraternity, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, to drink during beer parties. He met his future wife when she was a student at Wellesley. Wendy's classmates there included Hillary Rodham, who in some ways was her rival. Wendy was president of the class of 1969. Hillary was president of the student body. Paulson graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Dartmouth in 1968 with a major in English literature. Paulson had first come to Washington in 1970 after graduating from Harvard Business School, and at the time, he didn't even own a suit. Armed with a recommendation from one of his undergraduate professors at Dartmouth, Paulson landed a job as a staff aide to the Assistant Secretary of Defense, and would soon display some of the skills that would later make him such an effective salesman at Goldman Sachs. In just 2 years, he advanced to the White House, where he became Assistant Director of the Domestic Policy Council, then headed by John Ehrlichman, who would later be convicted of conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and perjury in the Watergate cover-up. Paulson served as a liaison with the Departments of Treasury and Commerce. Given how Hank moved from a low-ranking position in the Pentagon to the White House, you have to conclude he's got pretty good antenna for what's going on, recalled a friend and former Goldman executive, Kenneth Brody. But when Watergate came, there was never a mention of Hank. When Wendy became pregnant with their first child in 1973, Paulson, eager to earn some money, decided to leave the Nixon White House and started looking for work in the financial sector, but not if it meant living in New York. He interviewed with a number of financial firms in Chicago, and of all the offers he received, he was most attracted to two Manhattan firms with major Chicago offices, Solomon Brothers and Goldman Sachs. He decided on Goldman after Robert Rubin, a Goldman partner and future Treasury Secretary, Gus Levy, a legend at the firm, and John Whitehead, among others, convinced him that he could be successful there and never have to live in Gotham. His salary, $30,000. In January 1974, Paulson moved his family back to where he had grown up, Barrington Hills, a town of fewer than 4,000 residents northwest of Chicago. Paulson bought 5 acres of the family farm from his father, who was a wholesale jeweler. There, up a winding road from his parents' home, he built an unpretentious wood and glass house, nestled among tall oak trees at the end of a half-mile driveway. At Goldman, Paulson was given an unusual amount of responsibility for a junior investment banker. "You know, Hank, we ordinarily don't hire guys as young as you into this role, but, you know, you look old," Jim Gelder, a senior partner, told him, referring to his rapidly receding hairline. Having quickly proved himself with important Midwestern clients like Sears and Caterpillar, he was soon marked as a rising star at the firm's Manhattan headquarters. In 1982, he made a partner, placing him in an elite group of men and a few women who were entitled to a bigger share of the bonus pool. When he became co-head of investment banking and a member of the firm's management committee from Chicago, he was obliged to spend a great deal of time on the phone, which he did somewhat famously, leaving interminable messages at all hours of the day. Only 4 years later, in September of 1994, however, Goldman Sachs was in turmoil. An unexpected spike in interest rates around the world had hit the firm hard, sending profits tumbling more than 60% during the first half of the year. Stephen Friedman, the firm's chief executive, suddenly announced he was resigning. 36 other Goldman partners soon left, along with their capital and connections. To staunch the bleeding, the firm's board turned to John Corzine, Goldman's soft-spoken head of fixed income. The directors saw Paulson as a natural number two, who would not only complement Corzine, but send a signal that investment banking, Paulson's specialty, would remain as key an area as ever for Goldman. They were betting that Corzine and Paulson could form a partnership as powerful as that of Friedman and Robert Rubin, and before them, John Whitehead and John Weinberg. There was only one problem with the plan. Neither man cared much for the other. At a meeting at Friedman's apartment on Beekman Place, Paulson expressed resistance to the idea of working under Corzine, or even to relocating to New York, which he had doggedly avoided all these years. Corzine, who was known to be especially persuasive in one-on-one encounters, suggested that he and Paulson take a walk. "Hank, nothing could please me more than to work closely with you," Corzine said. "We'll work closely together. We'll really be partners." Within an hour, they had reached a deal. On arriving that year in New York, Paulson moved quickly. He and his wife looked at dozens of apartments in just a few days. After narrowing the list down to two, Paulson walked quickly through the rooms of each, cell phone pasted to his ear, and signaled to his wife his choice. Then he ran to catch a plane. As president and chief operating officer, respectively, Paulson and Corzine worked tirelessly in the fall of 1994 to address Goldman's problems, traveling around the world to meet with clients and employees. Paulson was given the unenviable task of cutting expenses by 25%. Their efforts paid off. Goldman Sachs turned around in 1995 and had strong profits in both 1996 and 1997. Yet the crisis convinced Corzine and some others at Goldman that the firm needed to be able to tap the public capital markets so that it could withstand shocks in the future. The solution, they believed, was an initial public offering. But Corzine did not have a strong enough hold on the firm when, in 1996, he first made the case to its partners for why Goldman should go public. Resistance to the idea of an IPO was strong, as the bankers worried it would upend the firm's partnership and culture. But with a big assist from Paulson, who became co-chief executive in May 1998, Corzine ultimately won the day. Goldman's initial public offering was announced for September of that year. But that summer, the Russian ruble crisis erupted, and long-term capital management was teetering on the brink of collapse. Goldman suffered hundreds of millions of dollars in trading losses and had to contribute $300 million as part of a Wall Street bailout of long-term capital that was orchestrated by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. A rattled Goldman withdrew its offering at the last minute. What was known only to a small circle of Paulson's closest friends was that he was actually considering quitting the firm, tired of Corzine, New York, and all the internal politics. However, the dynamic at Goldman shifted dramatically in December 1998. Roy Zuckerberg, a big Corzine supporter, retired from Goldman's powerful executive committee, leaving it with only five members: Corzine, Paulson, John Thain, John Thornton, and Robert Hurst. At the same time, Goldman's board had become increasingly frustrated with Corzine, who had engaged in merger talks with Mellon Bank behind their backs. A series of secret meetings in various apartments quickly followed and resulted in a coup worthy of Imperial Rome or the Kremlin. Persuaded to stay and run the firm, Paulson and the three other committee members agreed to force Corzine's resignation. Corzine had tears in his eyes when he was told of their decision. Paulson became sole chief executive, with Thain and Thornton as co-presidents, co-chief operating officers, and heirs presumptive. And in May 1999, shares of Goldman made their trading debut in a $3.66 billion offering. By the spring of 2006, Paulson had stayed longer in the CEO spot than he had expected and had risen to the very top of his profession, He was awarded an $18.7 million cash bonus for the first half of the year. In 2005, he was the highest-paid CEO on Wall Street, pulling in $38.3 million in total compensation. Within Goldman, he had no challengers, and his hand-picked successor, Lloyd Blankfein, was patiently waiting in the wings. The bank itself was the preferred choice as advisor on the biggest mergers and acquisitions, and was a leading trader of commodities and bonds. It was paid handsomely by hedge funds using its services, and it was emerging